Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits with Indiana's senior U.S. Senator, Republican Todd Young. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Senator Young, I guess it's the first time as a senator we've welcomed you back to the program. You were on several times as when you were still in the House of Representatives. It's good to have you back here in the studio.
Well, thank you for having me back. Good to be with you, John.
So we've got to deal with what I call the gorilla in the parlor, the release of the Mueller report. And I'm going to set this up in the interest of fairness to say that you have been traveling here in the state today, and actually you've been here for a couple of days, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, a couple of days down in Evansville and then here in the Indianapolis area, and I was just up in Anderson visiting the Nestle factory. So we're traveling around quite a bit.
Yeah. So my point is you have not had a chance to read all 448 pages of the redacted report. Have you had a chance to glance at any of it?
No, I haven't. I'm aware that AG Barr had a press conference prior to the release, or maybe it was in conjunction with the release mm-hmm. of the redacted report today. I spoke with my staff on the way over here about to get a readout of some of the things that I understand were said at that press conference. I'm glad that finally the American people have their eyes on what my understanding is typical. They're allowed to have their eyes on the redactions consistent, again, I understand, with previous precedent.
So when you do get a chance to read it, what things are you going to be looking for? What are the areas that you still have questions about or would like to know more about?
Well, one of the things I found interesting in my conversations with my staff was, number one, there's absolutely no question among Republicans or Democrats, certainly those with whom I dialogue, that Russia interfered with our election, that they engaged in a disinformation campaign to further divide the American people against one another. I think we all have to acknowledge that they succeeded
they did.
In that respect. So I'll be looking for additional information that can sort of adorn all of that. I'll also be looking to see what they did with respect to the Hillary Clinton campaign. They stole documents. They hacked into the computers of that campaign. And we don't want foreign entities to engage in our election processes. And this has to be avoided moving forward. All of this is important, John, because we still have an ongoing investigation within the U.S. Senate on our Intelligence Committee pertaining to this very issue. And some of these issues are also being examined by our Judiciary Committee. So at some point, I may be asked to either vote on remedies to these sorts of foreign actions against us, our candidates, campaigns, and really our civil society. We need to come up with prophylactic measures.
Do you, in that spirit, do you wish that the president had made this process less about him and more about, you know, the case that you just advanced, the threat to the country, the fact that that this was an assault really on American institutions and American systems? He, it seems to most observers, he's characterized it as a witch hunt and all of that, has seen it as a personal attack. When for some people, I think, admittedly a dwindling band of Americans who try to look at things somewhat dispassionately, we think, well, it doesn't matter, if they were trying to help a Republican or a Democrat. These are supposed to be our choices as Americans to make, not the Russians.
Yeah. I haven't put myself, and suppose I should, in the president's shoes. with respect to this situation. I think to some extent the president has been personally mm-hmm. under assault or felt that way. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine as this investigation has gone on. But by all accounts, there's been cooperation mm-hmm. by the administration in terms of getting the information that's needed. There was no redaction whatsoever, I understand. This is another thing that my staff member told me as I came over here. There was no redaction by the president's attorneys before mm-hmm. this report was made public. So all of those things are being shared. So, I would expect there would be, and there needs to be, continued cooperation on a number of these matters. But my hope is ultimately, and I don't know when that will come, I hope sooner rather than later, we can move beyond the tension between Republicans and Democrats, personalities that don't mix well, mm-hmm. and just focus on solving these problems, protecting our election processes and their integrity, and maybe even come together as a nation and solve some of these lingering public policy challenges that still need to be solved during a time when our economy is fundamentally changing. Mm-hmm. People are starting to question whether or not Washington can solve some of these larger challenges. So, that's. I hope we get to that point, John.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Indiana's U.S. Senator Todd Young. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I understand the arguments, and I think a lot of people do understand the arguments about redacting portions of this report for the general public. But shouldn't members of Congress be able to see the unredacted report? Would you hope?
I think that's a fair question. It's a question of precedent. It's also a question of practicality. I think there's a practical matter. It's highly unlikely that an unredacted report would not have at least portions of that would otherwise be redacted leaked to the press. And it's unfortunate that I have to say that. And I, of course, am not going to name any names or speculate as to who might leak that report. It could be members of the staff if they had access to it. I've got great respect for my colleagues, work well with them. But I think many of them would fair-mindedly acknowledge that there's a high risk of leak were that to happen. And then we'd be right where we started, which is revealing to the American people grand jury testimony that never should be shared publicly or without some rare exceptions. Revealing to the American people some testimony from people who were indicted but ultimately found to be not guilty of particular crimes. We don't want to set that kind of precedent. Otherwise, the incentive to cooperate in the future in these types of cases will be much diminished.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Roger. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Roger writes, ask him, meaning you, if he reads any of the comments when he posts his fluff pieces on Facebook. They are 95% negative, and most point out his unwillingness to have any town halls. And then he wants me to ask if you are afraid to face your constituents in a town hall meeting.
No. Thank you. What was the gentleman's name?
Roger.
Roger, I do appreciate your comments, your unvarnished feedback, if you will, and thank you for visiting my social media page. I do not personally pore through the various comments. If I spent all my time staring, sort of narcissistically looking for encouragement or instead in a dispirited way, fixating on those negative comments, I wouldn't be serving the people of Indiana well. But my team does monitor the content to make sure it's appropriate and family-friendly platform on which to present one's views. Many of the individuals I've been briefed who post comments on my social media don't live in Indiana, and others do. Others just have real serious concerns. Sometimes they're critical of my views. Other times they're supportive, and sometimes they're somewhere in between. And I learn from those. I have my staff select out particular responses and brief me on those that they think would be instructive to me or add some value to my understanding of an issue, or just make me more empathetic to those I represent. With respect to town hall meetings, I did hold a number of them early on when I was running for Congress and for a number of years thereafter. I found over a period of years that having roundtable conversations where I can have a back and forth exchange with people and group dynamics don't take over is a lot more constructive, not just for me, but for those counterparties, those fellow Indiana citizens with whom I'm dialoguing. I learn a lot more that way. I think they learn a lot more about my perspective and my approaches that way. And it makes me a more effective legislator. I will be candid. These town hall meetings very frequently turn into political exercises, staged events designed to capture...
To mobilize bases on both sides.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals all do it. And I just haven't found them to be particularly constructive. And that's unfortunate.
And it we may have to pick this up. We're about 2 minutes from a break here. But that raises a question, because one of the things, recent bits of news attached to your name, was that the Lugar Center named you as, I think, the seventh most bipartisan member
of
the U.S. Senate, which one would think in normal and sane times would be something to be proud of. But obviously, you look at the other Hoosier senator, who was actually a couple of slots above you, got taken out in the last election. And, of course, Senator Lugar himself fell to that. Are you... Does it worry you at all that you actually can be punished for listening to people who disagree with you?
No, it really doesn't. And for my Republican or conservative friends out there, it's really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I'm the seventh most bipartisan senator, and these indices vary from year to year, of course. But most recently, I was also named the seventh most conservative senator. So one can work with people on the other side of the aisle, even with colleagues who share different perspectives on a whole host of issues, and achieve a workable outcome, one that improves the lives of rank-and-file Americans. It's just important that we not be so wedded to ideology that we can't make principled concessions and arrive at principled compromises, and I'll never apologize for that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with United States Senator Todd Young, a Republican from here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so in several ways. You can call us toll-free at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. When we come back from this break, we're going to start talking about some of the senator's public policy initiatives in office. Until then, I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with U.S. Senator Todd Young. He's a Republican from here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named David has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. David writes, "We have seen many attempts at a lot of different gun policy changes, but I'm wondering why Congress cannot pass a universal background check for all firearms purchases, public and private. An overwhelming amount of the American people are for this, but Congress can't seem to pass this. Why not?"
Yeah, this is an issue that, as you might imagine, I have a lot of constituents that feel strongly about, sort of at both ends of the spectrum. Those who look at the recent Supreme Court decisions about the Second Amendment and mm-hmm. and the interpretations and think that the Supreme Court got it right, that the Second Amendment protections afforded to Americans to bear arms are indeed quite broad
and pertain to individuals too,
and pertain to individuals, and furthermore pertain to apply to the states as opposed to just the federal government, mm-hmm. right? And then on the other hand, individuals who may be skeptical of those rulings, but irrespective of the court decisions, they still just want us to act. And I understand that sentiment mm-hmm. because when you have some horrific mass casualty events that occur, and we can think of several that mm-hmm. have occurred in recent years, whether it's Las Vegas or Columbine going back years further, yeah. Parkland more recently, even an avoided tragedy, mass tragedy in Noblesville, yeah. where there was, unfortunately, some damage done. People want their elected officials to act. And sometimes in cases like this, there aren't a lot of clearly good or evidence-based options which we know would be effective. RAND Corporation, a respected research outfit mm-hmm. that I think very few people ever accuse of having a political bent to it, recently did a study surveying all the different public policy mm-hmm. options that are put forward to assess from their viewpoint whether the evidence base supported some of these different strategies. And the one that is sort of seared in my mind that really could move the needle is addressing mental health issues. Mm-hmm. This of course, not only impacts those who pick up firearms and use them to engage in mass casualty events, but it infects much of our society. So to the extent we can continue to fund mental health provision, to the extent we can make it accessible to rank and file Americans, and we can normalize the notion that there ought to be no stigma whatsoever around addressing mental health needs, I think that's the most important tool that is at our public policy disposal right now.
To get to David's question, though, yeah. is there a point where, with that, where guns can be part of that discussion and conversation? Because I think the frustration he is speaking to is, to use some of the points you were making in the last segment, the extremes seem to be driving
yeah.
this discussion, and it is preventing rational people from sitting down and saying, okay, let's put everything that we can on the table and try to solve this problem.
I think guns should be part of the conversation when violence occurs through the use of a gun. In Columbine, you'll recall years ago, mm-hmm. and I just learned this not too long ago from mm-hmm. the father of one of the victims. The plan there was actually not to use guns, but instead to use propane canisters mm-hmm. blown up all around the area. We had a mentally ill young person, and so that was the problem. So we have to be careful here. But yes, I do think guns should be part of the much broader conversation. Here in Indiana, for example, it did inform lawmaking when we passed our red flag law, which would allow law enforcement to go and take firearms away from an individual who they had reasonable cause to believe posed a harm to themselves or, more importantly, as importantly, to others. And then after going through a court proceeding, the owner of those firearms could get those firearms back. So that by the way, is the most robust, strictest red flag law in the country here in the state of Indiana. So there are certain contexts where it has been, and it should be a part of the conversation, yes.
We are talking with U.S. Senator Todd Young here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Andrew has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hey, John, thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I just had a couple brief questions, completely and totally unrelated. You know, the first one, obviously, Senator Young ran against Evan Bayh for his election. But obviously, Senator Birchbayh recently passed, and his accomplishments as a legislator are just phenomenal. And to operate in that context of Congress, I'm just curious as what, you know, Senator Young sees Senator Bayh's legacy and how he feels about, you know, operating in that same state, in that same context. And then a follow-up and completely unrelated question, I'm curious as to his thoughts on the Mueller report. Because I'm still trying to get my head around it. It seems to me that it's saying that, you know, the result is there can be no indictment because you can't indict a sitting president, but if there were to be one, there could be, but for the president's staff obfuscating him at every point and not following his command. So two completely, totally unrelated questions, and I'll take my answer.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Andrew. And I will remind everyone again that Senator Young has not yet had a chance to read the Mueller report.
Why don't I engage the latter one first? I have not yet had a chance to read the Mueller report. I'm not aware of allegations, observations, or substantiation that individuals around the president, his legal team, or other staffers have obstructed investigative objectives or efforts. That would be news to me.
I apologize for interrupting, but I think what Andrew was saying is that actually – the president tried to obstruct, and his staff actually attempted to stop him from doing that, that if they'd followed through on his directives, that would have constituted obstruction.
Okay. This all gets very complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I apologize I apologize, Andrew, if I did not do justice to your point.
No, thank you, Andrew. And again, not having read the report, I'll do my best. We said in sort of the lead into this interview that I had an opportunity to get a secondhand readout of the Attorney General's press conference as he released the report. So that's all the information I'm operating on. But with that said, I think there were some theories put forward by Mueller pertaining to obstruction. And the Attorney General did not accept those legal theories or all of those legal theories as valid. But he said, I'm going to go ahead with the structure of these theories and based on those theories determine whether or not we had obstruction of justice. And in his assessment, even using Mueller's legal theories, there was no obstruction by the president. So that's the best I can do on that one. Your first question,
Birchbayh,
pertained to Birchbayh
and his legacy.
And his legacy, as I said in the wake of Birchbayh's passing, he's a modern day founding father. He's done more to rewrite the Constitution of the United States than any other individual, which is a source of pride if you happen to be a Hoosier. And for a person who serves in the same capacity, it's incredibly humbling to hear that he even got one constitutional amendment through. That's an indelible legacy. It's unlikely to be repeated in my lifetime or for a really long period of time. But for me, it's inspiring that, somebody can go to Washington, D.C. and work on some incredibly consequential issues, get things done, make your mark. And the name Birch Bayh is not a name known throughout the country. It is among, I suppose, people who follow politics very closely, people who have been active in the Democratic Party. But he was not a president. He doesn't bear the name Kennedy, so it's not quite the household name. But he left his mark. He advanced his values, and I think, so many values shared by the American people, and very few legislators can say that after a long career. So I've got great respect for him.
There are two things I kind of want to pursue on that point. The first one is we did a show, obviously, on his passing, the day that it broke. And out of that conversation and then some of the images I saw from that era make you aware, aside from the policy contributions that he and that cohort of senators had was also a spirit of camaraderie and collegiality. I talked with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar before we went on the air, and he spoke, not just with respect, as you would expect of Dick Lugar, for Birch Bayh, but genuine affection for the man, even though they ran against each other at one point, and Bayh beat him. Senator Lugar talked about, it was those personal relationships in the Senate that allowed us to get things done. And, could you talk a little bit about, because I don't think it is that way any longer. There is that spirit of...
There actually is.
Okay.
I'm not going to pretend that it permeates the halls of Congress to the extent it once did, but I believe we can get there again. Look, I've got very good working, positive, respectful relationships, genuine friendships with Maria Cantwell, who, by the way,
is a Hoosier.
Is a Hoosier. Yeah. with Maria Cantwell, with Chris Murphy, with Chris Coons. These are all Democrats. With Jeff Merkley, with Tim Kaine. I work with these individuals on legislation. We talk on the floor. We laugh together. We periodically will grab a meal or coffee together, in furtherance of our shared objectives, which is to move the country forward and to serve our constituents. And it's very hard to do if you don't have a measure of trust and empathy and even affection for the people with whom you work. It's just hard to work in an environment where you don't have that lubricant of friendship. So it does exist. Now, I'll say, John, this is not a critique of the media writ large. Our media is so important to our democratic process and the health of our republic. But in order to get on television these days, demonstrating the sort of comity and affection one has for one's colleagues is not the most compelling media typically, right? It doesn't get clicks from a mouse. It doesn't get eyeballs on a screen. And so I think that's one of the reasons we see and hear less about it. All that aside, in the midst of even the current political environment in which a lot of tribalism has taken hold, right? Mm-hmm. You're either an R or D and don't show any ambiguity about where you stand. You're on the left, you're on the right. There's still so much that gets done. I mean, look at the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. We have passed almost countless pieces of legislation, important legislation, together on a bipartisan basis to get things done. Sometimes these bills have been very hard to put together because here again, we come at these things from different perspectives. We represent different constituencies. Even your Congress of the United States tends to step up when there's a genuine crisis at hand.
The other thing is that obviously that you mentioned that Birchbeyer was the author of not one but two amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Not many people get to do even one. You attempt.
He almost got three done. He almost got three done. And Title IX came in the wake of Title IX, which of course expanded women's rights. That was something that Congress passed in the wake of his third effort to get a constitutional amendment passed.
Yeah, well, I was going to say you aspire to become a member of that club yourself, right? You've started a campaign to amend the Constitution, correct? Was that the number of Supreme Court justices?
Oh, yeah, I co-sponsored
an
effort that Marco Rubio actually put together, and that was just to keep constant the number of justices we currently have. So for a number of reasons, we want to make sure that there's some continuity in the Republic. It's been about 150 years, and nine justices has worked pretty well. And during a time when there's all kinds of flux in our politics and distrust of institutions, if we create a sense that the judicial branch is nothing more than a political branch like the others, one which can be expanded through election of a president of one's party every 4 years, then that's going to create a real problem. I also think that confirmation hearings, most recently the Kavanaugh hearing, have become incredibly poisonous. Can you imagine how bad the hearings would be if we went through this effort to pack the courts or expand the size of the Supreme Court? So I think it would create some real problems.
Was it a mistake? I mean, Senator McCain said that the Senate needed to go back to the old way of confirming justices, which meant you had to get to 60 votes. That assured, proponents said that meant you got something more resembling consensus candidates. Opponents said you tended to get watered down candidates for the nation's highest bench. Was it a mistake to do away with those long-held Senate procedures?
Yeah, I think that time will tell. Time will tell whether or not it was a mistake. But I think the longstanding rules that we've had are just that. They're rules within the Senate. And when those rules are being change for circuit court judges, as they were in recent years by the other party, and change for district judges at their convenience. One does feel like when your president is elected, that president ought to be able to nominate and have confirmed his or her justices. There's some nuances to this.
We can pick them up after
like
the break.
We are
talking with U.S. Senator Todd Young today on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us.
Good afternoon. Support for No Limits comes from listeners who donate to WFYI and from Agrinovis, Indiana. Committed to the intersection of ag plus bio plus science is happening here. Visit agrinovisindiana.com. And from Broadway in Indianapolis, announcing Waitress at Old National Center for a limited one-week engagement, April 23rd to the 28th. Ticket information at broadwayinindianapolis.com. And from Crafted, introducing Crafted Labs, a product lifecycle offering that starts with research and design and ends with a scalable go-to-market ready MVP. Now accepting applications at labs.craftedup.com. You can send questions or comments to No Limits via social media. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. We're on Twitter at WFYI. Or call 866-476-3881.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today on No Limits with U.S. Senator Todd Young. He's a Republican from here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can do what one listener did and reach out to us via Twitter at WFYI. This listener wants to know what are you doing to address infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana, especially among Black mothers and infants?
Oh.
We rank only a few from the bottom in both. Why isn't this a statewide emergency?
I'm very eager to dive into that question. I felt like I didn't do the previous call-in or questioner justice, so I'm going to return to that. I get a little distracted.
I'll tell you what, I would give you a chance to come back.
Thanks.
So why don't we come back to the answering the judicial question? Don't worry, listener, we will talk about maternal and infant mortality.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about that. So. The one thing that I just wanted to add is that the rules in the United States Senate have in the modern era required 60 votes in order to end debate and then to be able to vote up or down with a simple majority on the substance, whether it's of a nomination and whether or not said nominee should be confirmed or a piece of legislation. And that is rarely invoked when you have non-controversial nominees emerging from committees. So if you have an ambassador to Germany that is unanimously voted out of the Foreign Relations Committee, typically in very short order, that person comes to the floor. There's not 60 hours of debate spent on that nominee, and business can move forward. In fact, during the Obama years, there was a couple dozen instances, not very many, in which the full amount of time was used for these judicial nominees. Well, we're well over 100 now here during this era. So this has taken on an order of magnitude that's different than the previous era. And because the rules, many of us felt, were being abused, we had to change the rules. That's why the Senate really, in the end, is not led by rules. The Senate is ultimately led by certain norms of behavior. And if we're not behaving ourselves, if we're not respecting our colleagues, then the rules will almost certainly be changed. And my concern is that having been, from my viewpoint, ineluctably led to take this step so that judicial vacancies could be filled so that this president could fill essential ambassadorial posts and other positions throughout the government. My concern is that someday the rules might be changed on the so-called legislative calendar so that when we're debating health care or when we're debating maybe even a Green New Deal, something like that, a simple majority would be enough to pass these pieces of legislation. I think having a body like the United States Senate, where we are required institutionally to develop a measure of consensus across parties, 60 votes is what it's been in the modern era, is healthy and it leads to more sustainable policy solutions and, frankly, less disagreement across factional lines. So I just wanted to do justice to your questioner there.
And then we should talk about infant and maternal mortality, too. I need to bring it back
absolutely.
To that. Absolutely. We both promised the listener we would do that.
Well, I've spent some time on this issue. When I ran for the United States Senate and began my service, I said that it was my intention to represent every single Hoosier, regardless of where you live, what zip code you grew up in, what your financial circumstances are. So, John, I spent about half of my time during my first couple of years in office when I was back here in Indiana traveling around lower income areas. Some people will call them distress zip codes. I call them opportunity zip codes because there's a whole lot of untapped potential in these areas. People just need the right supports and encouragement in order to be able to realize their full human potential. I held roundtable conversations. I read fairly extensively, and one of the things that came up time and again as a priority was addressing this issue of high rates of infant mortality, poor maternal health, especially in our lower income communities. And so I looked around for solutions. Our not-for-profit community, arguably the most vibrant sort of civil society in all of human history, going back to the early parts of our country's history, they have, if not solved it, they've certainly come up with evidence-based solutions. There's one of those that's being implemented right here in the Indianapolis area and increasingly in different parts of the state called the Nurse Family Partnership. Mm-hmm. The Nurse Family Partnership dispatches a healthcare worker paired with a social worker into lower-income areas to visit with expectant mothers, to teach that mother in an environment where she is comfortable about the importance of some basic components of maternal health and support that mom through the process. And then after the child is born, hopefully as a healthy baby, the social worker will continue to show up and help the mother learn the importance of, for example, stimulating that child's brain by speaking to the child, by reading to the child, and so forth. This leads to improved health outcomes, improved long-term educational outcomes, and even workforce outcomes, reduces bad healthcare outcomes for mothers, substantially decreases public expenditures on Medicaid. I mean, it's just a win-win-win all around. So what I have specifically done, aside from just talking about the issue and learning about it, is I developed a public-private partnership model where private investors can pool their money and scale up this this evidence-proven model mm-hmm. in different parts all around the country. And then if the government ends up saving money, if lives are genuinely improved and the Medicaid expenditures go down, we pay back those investors out of the avoided costs of actually helping people. And typically what these philanthropically minded investors will do, well, they'll recycle the avoided cost monies they receive and they'll help more people. So it creates this virtuous cycle of avoiding this horrible issue. This is now law. Mm-hmm. I got President Trump to sign this into law. It was broadly supported in a bipartisan fashion. And I'm hopeful that it will be adopted right here in Indiana.
We are talking with U.S. Senator Todd Young today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Dave has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Hi. And Senator Young.
Hi, Dave.
My concern is the NRA and the power that they have in Congress today. I think a lot of people are concerned about their Second Amendment rights. I used to be a hunter. I have no problem with guns. I have a couple in my home, and it's not a big deal. I really don't use them. They're more keepsakes. What I'm concerned about is the way the NRA markets itself. I don't believe they're protecting Second Amendment rights. I believe they are a lobbying organization for gun manufacturers. They're out there promoting fear and concern with the public under the auspices of or under the guise of protecting their Second Amendment rights when actually they're scaring people into buying more guns. And it's so counterproductive to a civil culture. I feel like they're, you know, they should not have the power that they do with legislators. And it's all threatening legislators. They threaten people with their what they consider their safety. They think the government is going to take their guns. so they should go out and buy more guns. I believe that all the NRA is doing is creating more sales of more product for gun manufacturers.
Thanks very much for the call, Dave. I'm going to give Senator Young a chance to respond.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, Dave, thank you very much. I don't want to ignore the fact that groups like the NRA and Planned Parenthood and many other advocacy organizations out there run television ads and digital ads and are active in the political process. That is indeed the case. I represent Hoosiers. I represent sportsmen and hunters like yourself. I also swore an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and I try and advance the public interest within that context, informed by the needs and desires of my constituents, and consistent with the rule of law. So I think we need to be attentive to the influence played by outside organizations, whether they're these sort of not-for-profit advocacy organizations or organized labor or large corporations or foreign governments. I think your comment is an important one. Well received.
Has the Citizens United, because in some ways what opened the door to a lot of this was the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that let a lot of, dark or even to some degree completely unregulated money flow into the system. And inevitably, because it's driven by whether it's right or left, someone with a specific interest, there almost everything that flows out of there is an attack on one person or one party or another. Has that been corrosive to the process here of trying to get to some of the sense of rapprochement that you've been talking about?
I came to politics fairly late. I did work for Senator Lugar from 2001 and until 2003. This was right after I mm-hmm. got out of the Marine Corps. But in terms of organized politics, I was a volunteer for Mitch Daniels on his campaign, did a little policy work, but didn't pay a lot of attention to how these campaigns were run, funded, or influenced by outside factors until, mm-hmm. frankly, when I ran for my own campaign for the U.S. House in 2010. And it seems to me I was surprised at the extent to which, frankly, these outside groups would impact races very mm-hmm. late in the game. And I have no question. I couldn't stare you in the eye, John, and say that doesn't influence some elected officials to do things that they might not otherwise do. So is that good for the process? Not when those things aren't in the public interest.
We are talking with U.S. Senator Todd Young today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having the show.
Certainly.
Senator Young, you spoke a little bit earlier about the importance of maintaining balance at the Supreme Court level. I believe our country is grievously out of balance with regard to the lack of representation of the electoral will on legion issues involving the remaking of our country and primarily the social safety net. The biggest exemplar and I think reason for that imbalance is gerrymandering. Could you look John or me in the eye and say, yeah, the electoral advantage that the GOP has in Indiana and nationally, and as we just saw in the governor's election in Georgia, yeah, it's fair, it's healthy, it doesn't need reform. And the amount of control that the GOP has with regard to health insurance in Indiana and nationally, appointing judges, remaking the entire social structure.
And John,
in a very quiet way, can you tell us that gerrymandering is representative of what's going on?
I'll quickly dispense
right
with
now?
This.
Well, yeah, no, John, the reason I'm cutting in on you here is we are getting close to the end of the program, and I wanted to give Senator Young a chance to respond to your question. Thank you very much for posing it, because it is an important one.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's a very important one. So, John, I can't conceive of an entirely fair-minded way to draw these districts. I certainly don't want to defend how some states have drawn them, but read the book The Big Sort, not The Big Short, The Big Sort. It's really fascinating about how migratory patterns within this country has over since really roughly 1980, if I recall, led people of a more liberal or progressive bent to live in liberal or progressive counties, and then conservatives tend to move towards conservative counties. It's not because of their politics. It just happens to be there's a strong relationship between one's purchasing or consumption habits and the type of boulevards they like to drive down and so forth on one hand, and their politics on the other. Republicans tend to live in areas that have more Applebee's and strip malls. It's a fact. Democrats tend to live in areas with more Indian restaurants and sort of Birkenstock shoe stores. Mm-hmm. These aren't just stereotypes. So as that has happened, and there's been more homogeneity politically, it becomes more difficult to draw the maps. With that said, when I ran for office in 2010, the deck was absolutely stacked against me because of the way our Democratic state legislature had drawn the maps. And it made me really frustrated. Mm-hmm. It took a very unusual election environment for me to get across the line and to win that race. So I am empathetic. I'm looking for a better way. I know there's a commission model out there that, say, Arizona has adopted. Two Republican commissioners, two Democratic commissioners, they work together to try and find a consensus fifth commissioner. It turns out that those models become politicized as well. So this, in the end, it's a prerogative of and a responsibility of our state elected officials to come up with a better way if the people of Indiana want it. But I have a tough time figuring out exactly what that better way is. I do want to acknowledge what you said, though. We need to be looking for ways for people to be more represented. Feel as though the system's not rigged against people of any particular political persuasion, as I felt several years ago.
And that, I'm afraid, will have to be the last word. We're running out of time. Senator Young, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us for this hour, particularly fielding questions on a report you haven't even read. You had a chance to read
it. It's been fun. It's amazing how quickly the hour goes. Thanks a lot for the opportunity, John. We'll be
Certainly.
Back.
Thank you. And I would say to our listeners, if you do want to hear more coverage on the Mueller report, Here and Now we'll be dealing with it at the top of the hour. Please tune in.
And if you want my weekly... If you'd like to receive my weekly newsletter, visit young.senate.gov.
I'm John
Kroll. Very informative.
You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.